Radio City, John Grace and Rob Ross once again coming to you and hanging out, just doing our thing on what is now a Tuesday. We're a little bit late this week because, oh boy, weather concerns have been there. And Rob, you dealt with the weather just over these last couple of hours, huh?
Yeah, New York City has been pelted by this storm that you had to deal with yesterday. That bizarre shade of very dark gray that the sky suddenly turns just before it's about to just explode into a downpour. And of course, just as I was a block away from the subway station, that's when those sheets of windy rain started hitting me. Fortunately, I made it without getting too soggy. It's already passed, though. That's the interesting thing. The sky just at the very end of it was an amazing shade of pink, and we got a rainbow, a really beautiful rainbow.
Oh, wow. At the end.
So it turned out all right, and as we started the show, I think the Mets actually started their ball game. Not that it's going to matter, because I highly doubt they're going to win against Toronto. But nevertheless, it came and it went quickly. I'd say all in all, a four-hour span.
Yeah, that was the thing. Yesterday when it came through here, through St. Louis, it was we kind of got the bottom edge of it. So even though it was moving very fast, and you're right, I mean, it blew through at about 50 miles an hour. And usually what happens is we get one line. And so it's 50 miles an hour, which means it's like hell for about 15 minutes, and then everything's fine again. It's almost like being back in Florida. But this time, because we were on the bottom edge of it, it lasted a lot longer as it went by us. And as I was on my way home last night, I saw something I had never seen before. There was a power pole that I guess something had either blown into or something had gone wrong, and it started arcing. So there was a spark probably a good 8 inches long that was just constant. You know, this bright blue, it almost looked like a lightsaber. And the pole that it happened on just happened to have a transformer on it. So that thing exploded. And as I was driving by, so I got this great light show. So I'm sure there were a few people that weren't happy about losing power, but it was pretty.
Well, I'll tell you what, I remember, and it happened in the summer of 87, because it seemed to rain almost constantly throughout July.
Yeah.
I was driving my girlfriend, rest her soul, home one night, and we were in the car, and it didn't seem like it was going to rain at that moment, but all of a sudden, and I'd say we were about maybe two lights away from this enormous bolt of lightning actually came down and struck a transformer on the pole, and
wow.
We saw this thing. It's like watching a movie from the distance, you know, and we saw the thing just explode, and cars just kind of like turning themselves as quickly as possible because you could see that the pole was about to come down.
Yeah.
You know, I never like being outdoors when it's this kind of weather, not because of the rain, but because of what could happen. You know, the storm was already passing when I got off the ferry, but lightning was starting to come down.
Yeah. And
that's really off-putting.
Well, you reminded me of a story that I haven't thought of many times since then, but back in, it had to be, you know, it may very well have been the summer of 87. I'll have to go back and check the tour schedule. But Pink Floyd, the reformed Pink Floyd, was playing A Momentary Lapse of Reason at Tampa Stadium. And we went out to see the show. We didn't end up going into the show. We just sat at the parking lot of the mall across the street and listened to the show because we were all broke. And we got home. We were dropping off a friend of ours in a little town in Florida called Apollo Beach. And Apollo Beach Boulevard goes straight through town, as you might imagine, except there's this one piece of it right near US 41 where it jogs. So it ends up going exactly the same direction right out to the beach, but there's this little jog in it. So we made that, and we were driving home, and we dropped our buddy off at his house. And as we were standing in the driveway talking, the entire sky went bright blue, flashed blue. And this is the middle of the night. It's, you know, 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night. And we looked up, and we're like, what the hell was that? And then it did it again. And then all of a sudden, the sound followed, and there was this bzzz noise. And so we all hopped back in the car and drove back up Apollo Beach Boulevard. And when we got to that part where it jogged, we found out what happened, because it was a clear blue sky. Well, dark, but, you know, clear skies and actually decent weather in Florida for once. What happened was there were two kids that decided to race down Apollo Beach Boulevard. And one of them made that little jog at the end and the other one didn't, and went right into the power pole. And it was the one that had the transformer on it. So, yeah, it was not a good night for the people in that car.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy times, man. But yeah, like you said, this is the reason why you got to be careful with that stuff. Electricity is the one thing I do not screw around with.
No.
So that said, on to happier tidings. We've got a bunch going on in the news this week. We've got a whole bunch of music to talk about. And I don't even know where to begin, honestly. So you take it. What are we talking about first?
Well, let's just start with the basics. We now know who's in the semifinals for the Stanley Cup.
Yep.
Vegas and Winnipeg are tied one game apiece in their series. It looks like Tampa Bay is being manhandled by Washington because they're down 2-0.
Yeah.
There's no score at the last look that I had. But they've been very ugly losses, especially the other night. Sunday night was just poor play by Tampa because they gave up 3 fast goals to Washington.
Yeah, and it's
they just seem to have no sense of recovery. They're being outmatched. They're being physically outmatched. There's a lot of passion in that Washington lineup. I think Ovechkin wants to prove a point. The thing is, I think far and away, Tampa Bay is the much more talented team.
Yep.
They should be peppering them with goals left, right, and center because I don't think Holtby's that great of a goaltender.
Right. Well, and what you said is true. They are being manhandled, and I think what they were hoping for is that Washington was going to play to Tampa Bay's strength, that Tampa was going to be able to play a much more finesse kind of game. And Washington went in and started punching them in the face, and they did not respond well to that. Like you said, gave up 3 early goals. So it's going to be hard for them to shift gears in the middle of this thing like that. And it may very well be 4 games and out for Tampa. I hope it isn't, but it looks like it may be headed in that direction.
I mean, if they win tonight's game, okay, then that may spark some relief.
Yep.
You know, the thing is that instead of letting themselves be punched in the face, they need to start punching back, which is very obviously what Vegas did, because certainly that first game in Winnipeg, they were out to prove a point to Jets. Vegas responded very nicely last night with a good, solid win. So we shall see. It's an interesting scenario, to say the very least. I have to admit I'm disheartened of the fact that the Preds just let themselves be manhandled by Winnipeg.
Yeah.
They're the better team overall, but, you know, and the sad part is that's a team that was built for the cup run that they made both last year and this year, and I think now the dismantling begins. Certainly Mike Fisher has retired again, so that's a loss right there. You know, of course, they don't have James Neal this year, but Neal is doing – just fine on his own with Vegas.
Yeah.
And, so,
yeah, right. And we, you know, moving into baseball, it's been an interesting week for both of our teams because Adam Wainwright has now been placed on the disabled list again. I was going to say the 15-day DL, but I think it's longer than that this time. Speculation among the Cardinal fans may be that this is it. This may be the one that he doesn't come back from. And, you know, if that happens, I don't know that there were many people who were excited about seeing him in the lineup for any more than sentimental reasons this year anyway, because he's a guy who's meant a lot to the team over the last few years. But there comes that time in every career when it's really time to look at hanging him up. And, you know, Mike Matheny has shown a great deal of affection for Wainwright, but I think it has now overstretched his play and his ability to contribute to the team. So it may actually be a good thing for the Cardinals to finally say goodbye to this guy.
And with the Mets, of course, the last time you and I spoke, it had been a case of the Mets had just waived Matt Harvey for the purpose of giving him his outright release, and we were all thinking the same thing. Nobody's going to take a chance with this guy because beyond the fact that he's physically damaged goods, he's a problem.
Right.
And what, maybe 24 hours later, they actually did a deal with the Cincinnati Reds while they were in Cincinnati. They made a deal for a catcher that Cincinnati's had on the roster for quite a while, and the Mets do need a catcher. And all he had to do was just walk across from one clubhouse to the other. Harvey was in Los Angeles working, quote unquote. Well, certainly Devin Mesoraco, the new catcher for the Mets, paid off dividends because in the 9th inning on Friday night when the Mets were down 2-1, 2-0, Michael Conforto came up, hit a game-tying home run. He hit the home run that gave the Mets the lead, and then Mesoraco came up next and hit a home run to give the Mets an insurance run, and they actually won that game. So that paid off. Harvey pitched four innings for the Reds in his debut. Yes, he went right into the starting lineup. Four scoreless innings against the Dodgers. For whatever reason, the Reds manhandled the Dodgers this weekend, which is a very strange thing to see. But he didn't get the win. Now, he got lucky on that first outing. Let's see how it goes from there.
Right.
I mean, at this point, I don't care. He's no longer with the Mets, and that's a headache removed. That the Mets got something for him, because the joke was, of course, we couldn't even get, you know, tape for the bats and a bag of balls for him. We got a baseball player and we got cash.
Yeah, you brought me right to Slapshot. What'd the old man trade for these guys? A used puck bag?
Exactly. Now, just one thing to say about Matt Harvey, though. Pussy.
There you go. And you know, I fear that we have done buried the lead, because the real story this week, over and above everything else that we could possibly talk about, more so than losing three incredible names out of the world of popular culture, and we'll get to them a little bit later on, more than the music and more than sports and more than anything else, Rob, what are you doing for the royal wedding?
This is what's known in the profession as dead air.
That's right. Oh, I am so sick of this shit. I can't even begin to tell you.
Air? Just because half of my bloodline happens to be English and I have a tattoo of the Union Jack on my arm, which was obviously a moment of insanity. I care not a whit.
I couldn't possibly bring myself to care about the English monarchy, which means absolutely nothing. And you talk about a bunch of self-entitled, overprivileged nothings. I mean,
not tax paying.
What have they contributed?
Multimillionaires.
Right. But what have they ever contributed to anything? You know, anything in any real sense?
Tell you what, they inspired the Sex Pistols to write a great song like God Save the Queen.
There you go. Okay. All right. That's one.
And Prince Philip was the one who put the idea into George Harrison's head to form the Traveling Wilburys.
No shit.
Yeah.
That's a story I don't know. That's really cool.
Yes. So, yeah, Prince Philip seems to be a pretty reasonable guy, and he hangs out with rock musicians. I mean, he's had Townsend around regularly for tea and things like that. So, you know.
It's just often he shoots his mouth off in the most spectacularly, mind-bendingly embarrassing ways.
I don't think he wants to be king of England. I really don't.
No.
I don't think he ever intended it, and he hopes that his mother keeps going the way she's going, and when the time comes and she passes, he'll probably take the crown for about 5 minutes and hand it over to his son. And I don't have a problem with William. I like the way he handled himself when he knighted Ringo. I thought that was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Because you could see I don't know if you saw the video clip. There, you couldn't hear the audio, but you could see this look of excitement on his face. It was genuine, because it wasn't, I'm going to be the king of England and I'm knighting one of the Beatles. It's like, oh my God, I'm knighting a Beatle. You know, it's like that, you could tell that was the look. You could see he just wanted to talk to Wingo.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that he gets it, and much more than the Queen does. And that's the thing, is all of the attendant crap with, oh, she's an American divorcee and she's of mixed race. Don't care. Oh, her father might not be there. Don't care. Oh, there's a scandal with a pop. I don't care.
Don't care.
Just, okay. No, no.
You know, keep going like this, we're going to wind up singing Clark Kent's Don't Care. So.
Yes. So to avoid that, back to our show, because
we deliver the show to you, folks, because we give you the laughs. We make the funny.
We do attempt. And with that said, it is time to go back into some of the darker side of the news, because we have lost some incredible names. And I want to start with Margot Kidder, probably if for no other reason than she was just the one that I think most of us knew at the youngest age, you know, that we were aware of her, not only because of Lois Lane, certainly that was a big part of it, and seeing that Superman movie. I think I was 7 when that came out. And so that was massive. And she did such a great job with that. But a couple of years earlier, she had made a couple of movies that were definitely worth watching. Certainly the Amityville Horror was one of them, but I didn't see that until much later. And then right after that, she made a movie when Richard Pryor was trying to break into serious acting, still with a little bit of comedy in it. He did a movie called Some Kind of Hero, where he played a tortured Vietnam vet who came back home and tried to reassimilate into society. And she was the hooker he ended up falling in love with. And she was amazing in that movie. She was really, her acting skills were really on display in that. And for the second half of the movie, she really carried it. And it was Franklin Ajayi, oddly enough, who carried the first half of it. But she showed that, she really had the chops. She wasn't just another pretty face who showed up in Playboy in 1972.
I remember her from years before that because she was in an early Brian De Palma film called Sisters.
Yes.
Where she played, what's the word that they use when they separate, a separated Siamese twin.
Right. Okay, yes.
And the most important thing is that it was shot right here, down the block from me.
Oh, Staten Island, really?
All on Staten Island. And so that's one of the earliest movies I remember seeing in Staten Island. But I remember because it was such a creepy and well-done film. And there was a very, very poor attempt at remaking it a few years ago and just wasn't even worth the time. I thought it was a great insult, frankly.
Okay.
But I remembered her from that, and I thought, okay, this is really good. And every time it was on, it always wound up on usually around 11:30, 12 o'clock on a Friday night on ABC, and they would do the late show kind of film.
Right, yeah, and they always showed those kind of, not horror movies outright, but creepy movies.
Right, the creepy chiller type things.
Yep.
But the other thing that people unfortunately will remember Margot Kidder for was for her very public breakdown.
Yeah.
Around 1996. Which was just a sad state of affairs, the way that she was splashed on the tabloids. When somebody has a genuine illness, I don't think that's the right time to start splashing. If it's somebody who's an abrasive irritant, fine. Right. They get what they deserve. But she was never offensive and she was never problematic.
You mean like, for example, if somebody's dying of cancer, maybe making a joke about how, they'll be dead soon wouldn't be in the best taste of all.
Right, especially if you're holding a press conference.
God. Okay, so back to Margot Kidder, though. We'll get back to the McCain thing. But yeah, she – funny quick story. My producer, Max, was telling me this, that he's big into the comic book conventions and all of that. And later on, because of the Lois Lane role, she made a lot of money and made a lot of appearances at those things. And he said she genuinely seemed to enjoy them, which a lot of those people don't. They do not look forward to, staying at another airport hotel and answering the same 10 fanboy questions, for hours. But she genuinely had a good time. And where he saw her, of all places, was Metropolis, Illinois, which is the home of Superman, and they have a big festival every year, and she was down there for that. And they also have a casino in town, and he happened to run into her in the casino, and she was playing the Superman slot machine. And he made mention of that. He was like, "That's really funny that you're playing this machine." And she pointed to her picture on the side of the machine and said, "I have to win. I'm on this machine." So, it's just, she had a laugh at her own expense. And anybody that does that is immediately higher up in my esteem.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So that's one.
That's one. Yeah. Also a great author.
Yeah. Tom Wolfe. I mean, yeah, Bonfire of the Vanities was a pretty good book.
Yeah. What it was.
But of course, my favorite piece of his work was naturally Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, mm-hmm. which is just I think it's a genuinely funny book. It's not one of those life changer books the way that, so many people tend to tout it. They put it up there with On the Road, but it's just hilarious and pithy and I hate the word because it's always aligned with him, but witty. It was genuinely witty. And that's the thing that, I felt he made much more human out of the whole hippie acid Mary pranksters
right.
kind of experience than the mythology that went behind it.
Yeah. And you look at the other work that he did, and even with The Right Stuff, the fact that his words, certainly the movies had been made before and documentaries had been made before about the space program, but his words seemed to translate so well to the screen. And I don't know how involved he was in the screenwriting process on that, but it just showed the talent of the author that you can take something like that, or like Bonfire of the Vanities, and make a movie out of it, and it works. I mean, how many authors have we seen that when movies are made from their work, they're just crap, and the movies that were made from his stuff were really good. It just worked.
Well, the thing is also the right stuff is a very powerful, genuinely American story.
Yep.
It's a historic piece of work, but at the same time, it's completely embraceable.
Yeah. And Wolf also, you're not to lose sight of this, in addition to the books, he also changed a lot of the way that reporting was done. I mean, he showed that you can show some humanity while you're reporting the news, long before he wrote any of the books. And that's the way things are done now. I mean, it's done poorly now, but you know, when he was doing it, doing that sort of immersive kind of reporting is something that was fairly new.
Well, we shall never see. There are those authors and writers that come along once in a lifetime, and we will not see someone of his ilk.
Same,
certainly the rest of our lifetime.
No doubt. And the same could be said about the last sad goodbye that we have for this week, because you have a guy that was as experimental as you can be with a guitar and still have it make some kind of sense. You know, it wasn't metal machine music, but it was something that was as sort of almost contrarian to the genre as that in Glenn Branca.
And he was a visionary. And the thing is, he wasn't just some musician. He was a composer, theorist, and a conductor. You know, he was the full Monty, as it were. And he always managed to come up with these ensembles because they were orchestras. That was his whole point. These guitar orchestras, which produced some of the most lauded musicians of our time, most notably Thurston Moore.
Yep.
And Lee Ranaldo are graduates of the Glenn Branca encampment, if you will. I believe Han Rowe and Tim Peacock and Tim Summer, all from Hugo Largo. I mean, there were so many that played with Branca, and he never really got, you know, it's funny, people always talk about Philip Glass, and I always looked at Glenn Branca as on the same level, but he never got that kind of lauding and critical acclaim and appreciation, and it just, that always kind of rankled with me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, yeah, the music itself was, it was daring. It was like he took the best of John Cage and put it to guitar, and then used some of the elements of Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band, because there's no way you could sit down and genuinely listen to it without discomfort. And I think that was part of it. It wasn't an in-your-face confrontational manner. It was a presentation.
Yeah, right.
The same thing could be said for Beefheart, because Beefheart's whole thing was what he thought of as blues and real American sounds and freeform jazz. And
yeah.
Branca did all of that within the constraints of guitars, and it was always about guitars.
Right, and the freeform nature of it is the thing that really attracted me to it, the fact that it was taking the whole Gram Parsons motif of alternative tunings and things like that and saying, all right, this thing is on the surface a very limiting kind of instrument, because you have 6 strings, you have what at best 18 frets or 22 frets, and there's only so much you can do with that. And he said, bullshit, let me show you. And that, I think, it's a great idea. As soon as you decide to break out of what people have decided is the norm, that's where you can find true genius. You can also find a lot of garbage there, but if it's in the right hands, and with Glenn Branca, it certainly was, you can find some things that are going to be absolute gems.
That's the thing. You can always find beauty in the abrasive.
Yep.
You know, I mean, look, it's over 30 years and I still love listening to Captain Beefheart just as much as I did then.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are some things that I can't listen to because it even gets to me after a while, because I don't think anybody has the turpitude to make it through all 4 sides of Trout Mask Replica. But, man, I can go back and listen over and over and over again and never tire of Safe as Milk or Dock at the Radar Station or Ice Cream for Crow.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, those three are just magnificent pieces of work, but this is not about Don Van Vliet. This is about Glenn Branca. So
indeed. And so, you know, to get away from all of that and to go back a little bit kind of to the news reporting that we were talking about with Tom Wolfe, there has been another machination, and I think it's time, even though this seems a very kind of, well, frankly, boring thing to talk about, the corporate maneuvering that goes on in the media world, it really is a tremendously important thing. And we talked a little bit about Sinclair and their corporate philosophy. And now the fact that they're climbing right into bed with Fox, it's starting to get kind of scary when you realize that that much of the media landscape is going to be controlled by a political viewpoint. Everybody has politics, true. But when you have the whole purpose behind keeping one company, which the FCC doesn't really do anymore, from controlling a newspaper, a television station, and a radio station in one market, or controlling more than three radio stations in any given market, the reasons why they did all those things still exist. It's just nobody pays attention to the rules anymore.
Well, then how does that play with the notion that Disney is trying to buy out Fox?
Right. So Disney buys out Fox, who now buys seven stations from Sinclair. And what do you have at the end of it all? You're going to have one guy who is going to be a Rupert Murdoch on steroids. And it doesn't matter what his political viewpoint is. You're going to have one guy who is going to be in control of so much of the voice of the country that whatever he says is going to be the narrative. And in the land of Donald Trump, that's a scary prospect.
Well, I mean, it already happened in the music industry, because how many major labels are there now? Three.
Uh-huh.
One which seems to control more than its legal share should be allowed.
But we'll leave Sony out of this.
Well, that's number two. Yeah. And then the third one is my alma mater, Warner Music Group, who have seemed to be turning profits, so hope springs eternal for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. They may not have gotten the Beatles catalog in the or the Beach Boys catalog in the carve-up of EMI, but they certainly didn't do too badly by getting everything else
right
that was on Capitol Parlophone. I mean, they had they got catalogs that they never had before, like Pink Floyd and the Hollies and everybody else that was on Columbia, HMV, and Parlophone. So, you know, talking about back catalogs, and then all the current artists like Coldplay and Radiohead and so on and so forth, Blur, you know.
Right.
So for whatever it may be worth, it shows that how little I care at this stage, because I don't even pay attention to see who's on these labels anymore. I mean, Paul Weller signed to Warner Music Group, you know, after the carve-up happened, and he signed to Parlophone, quote-unquote, in the UK, and Warner here. So, hey, you know, I'm good with that.
There you go. And yeah, again, the more control that there is over the voices, the less diversity there seems to be in any of it, whether it's diversity of opinion or diversity in music or whatever. So if that's the kind of thing you like, if you like carving out your own set of things that you enjoy listening to and watching and viewpoints that you enjoy and find enlightening, you're not going to have that. I mean, the more consolidation there is, the less of that there's going to be. So yeah, it's something to pay more attention to, I guess, than most of us are given to do. And it's not just because you and I both work in similar industries. It's something that needs to be brought to heel.
I dare say that all of this began, and I'm not making a political statement here, but you have to think, all of this deregulation and the allowing of mega mergers and the reintroduction of monopolies began under Clinton. Bill Clinton, that is.
Right, right.
For people who don't seem to understand the concept. But this began, you know, during the days of the dot-com booms.
Yeah, and just to show how little politics means in this, what didn't start under Clinton was actually started under Reagan. So you had massive deregulation under Reagan that Clinton said, oh, I can use this to make the economy better. Screw the consequences. We'll just go ahead and do it, and then I'll look like a genius. And 4 years later, he won again in a landslide, and the economy boomed for another 4 years, and then it tanked. So yeah, we were still left with all of the, you know, the regulations being trashed, everything just gone.
The fallout was just absolutely horrific. I mean, I remember, you know, there were in that mid period when I was working at Atlantic Records, there were a lot of people that left for these dot-com record labels that had started popping up because
right.
They were going to be the next big thing. Guess how much how quickly those people wound up unemployed again.
Yeah, because the place went out of business and locked the doors.
Right, it was also symptomatic of the whole dot-com boom and bust.
Yeah. Speaking of no oversight, as we jump from one topic to another, but speaking of the lack of oversight and what it can do for you, we're now starting to see what was everybody's darling just, 6 or 8 months ago, is now costing people money left and right, except those of us who are smart enough to stay the hell away from cryptocurrency. Because Bitcoin has it shot up from $1,000 of Bitcoin to 16 to 19, and now it's back to what? The last time I checked on it, it was at 8.
If it's not tangible and you can't see it, hold it, feel it, and trade it,
yeah,
it's not real.
Right.
And that's the bottom line. I mean, whoever thought cryptocurrency was going to become the thing to replace actual money was sorely delusional or a great snake oil salesman.
Yeah, right. And there's a zillion of them out there. I mean, Bitcoin is the biggest one because it's worth the most. But there's probably a couple of hundred cryptocurrencies out there. And the thing is, the built-in volatility, because why would you need it? You know, that's what I think people need to look at is it's fine to play around with this stuff and to speculate and all of that. But why would you really need that kind of anonymous online currency? And the only answer to that question that makes any sense is because you're involved in organized crime. So you're building an economy around organized crime. That doesn't sound smart.
No. And when it comes time to pay the tax bill, then what?
Yeah, right. Yeah, where's the Scarface you're going to go after?
Speaking of cryptocurrency, now that's the perfect lead-in for the next thing, because that was the backbone of the season finale of Silicon Valley.
Right.
Because we have this week a whole bunch of season finales and series finales. And I got to say, the season finale for Silicon Valley was just absolute genius. Brilliant, surprising, and just, it was a wow moment for that show. A real high watermark.
Well, yeah, and you had been saying that over the course of this season, because there had been so many changes, it's been a sort of an up and down season for them. They needed to end with a punch.
Yeah, and a positive punch at that. Because if it had ended the same way that it ended in previous seasons with, you know, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, I think a lot of people would just be turned off completely. But right. No, they acquitted themselves nicely. And last week we saw the season finale of CSI, which saw Pauly Perrette say goodbye.
Yep.
In a coma. There are no spoilers here, folks. I mean, you've seen it all by now. And if you're not watching it, well, you're not up on the parlance of pop culture as we are. Well, yeah. That's why we're here.
Right, and not only did Pauly Perrette exit NCIS, but now she's turned around and has taken a swat at them and the 15 years that she spent on that show, saying that it was a miserable experience for her and she suffered several physical assaults. She hasn't named any names yet, but this is on the heels of Mark Harmon taking a couple of shots from another former co-star on that show, who also left and left several years ago. I can't pull her name out of my memory banks right now, but you know, in a week where that happened and she was saying what a terrible experience it was to work with Mark Harmon, and then Pauly Perrette leaves and says, I suffered physical assaults on that show. I don't think it's much of a stretch to say, gee, I wonder if Mark Harmon may have been doing some things behind the scenes. And he's been married to Pam Dauber forever. So yeah. I have no idea what kind of guy he is. Never met him, never talked to him. But now with all of this going on, it really does make you start to wonder.
Well, let's get some facts before we go on another witch hunt.
Right.
To get rope ready. You know, let's because it becomes so tedious to hear blind accusations by disgruntled former employees.
Right. Well, and physical assault, she did not say, and this bears underscoring, she did not say sexual assault. She said physical assault. And I've worked with people who throw punches. So who knows? And whether it was Mark Harmon or a producer or any, you know, she didn't say. So you're right. We can't sit here and try to put the pieces together.
Now, this Friday night, ABC/Disney's Once Upon a Time signs off for the last time. I got to admit, I liked the show for the 6 of 7 seasons. They did a reboot of it,
yeah,
and brought it into, you know, the here and now, which just completely took me out of it, and I haven't watched it at all. So I may actually watch the finale just to see how it ends. does everybody get their happy ending?
Right.
You know, as because in its own way, in a very strange way, and I'm somebody who grew up absolutely loathing anything Disney. I really disliked all Disney films, characters, movies, whatever. I couldn't stand it. I was always of the Warner Brothers, Hanna-Barbera, Terry Toons kind of mindset. That was my thing.
It's more sarcastic.
And plus, just it was so – Disney was always limp-wristed. It always seemed like it was for girls.
Right, right.
Pure and simple. But there's a certain charm about the show, and God knows the women on that show are just gorgeous. So, you know, Lana Parrilla, forget it. Oh, best-looking woman on television, bar none. She's perfect as the Wicked Queen because she's just smoking hot.
You just want her to punish you.
Oh, God, yes. Actually, I want her to put on the Wonder Woman costume, tie me up with the golden lasso, and make me tell the truth.
There you go.
We're also getting to the near finale of The Americans, which has been very up and down. It started really strong, but the last two episodes just left me flat.
Yeah, honestly, we haven't even watched them. We will. I mean, we haven't given up on the show entirely. It'd be stupid to do that in the middle of the last season, but kind of got bored with it and thought, you know, there's other things on. We'll set this aside for a little while.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the only show that's really exciting, and God help me, is Jersey Shore Family Vacation.
No, that's frightening. That is just scary.
You know, at the end of the long day at work, rather than crack open a drink, I'd rather watch an episode with Pauly D and The Situation.
Oh, I can't comment. Reality TV has never held a fascination for me at all. So
this is like the highest of low points for train wreck television.
Yeah, yeah. And hey, at least it's not the Kardashians, man. This is the week of silence on the show. We're just going to have pregnant pauses and that'll be it.
Exactly.
But yeah, we're going to have to get into a little bit of the political scene before we get to the new music, because it's been so unfathomable. And again, I found myself being drawn in by that constant drumbeat from CNN and MSNBC. It's right around the corner. No, it isn't. Stop it. Nothing is right around the corner except more of this crap. And you know, when the word got out that what's-her-name, the White House staffer, had made a nasty joke about, you know, it doesn't matter what John McCain thinks, he'll be dead soon anyway. I thought, I can write the script. I can write the script from here. There's going to be calls for him to apologize. The Republicans in Congress are kind of sort of going to say, boy, you really should apologize, but we're not going to do anything to you if you don't. And they're going to not say a single word about it. And Donald Trump is going to bitch about how many leaks there are. And guess what happened?
Nothing.
Right. Exactly those things. And all of it is completely meaningless because at the end of the story, none of them give enough of a shit to do anything about him.
Now, the thing that troubles me is there are some tangibles here that, you know, the media focuses on an off-kilter, unnecessary comment by some White House staffer.
Right.
With a tasteless joke. With the fact that Trump withdrew from the U.S. from the Iran deal, which I think was actually quite smart because I was never for that deal. I thought it just gave way too much credence to a country that has never been trustworthy in any way, shape, or form and has shown themselves time and time again, even under the auspices of the deal, to thumb their nose at the United States and what the deal entails. You know,
it was an in, though. The only thing I would argue with there is at least it was an in. Before that deal was signed, we had no access, nothing. And they could sit there and buy all the yellow cake they wanted. And all we could do is sit back and let Israel go in and bomb them every so often. At least under the Iran deal, we had some kind of access. And now it makes us look even worse that he did this, because we signed that deal and he didn't pull us out of the Iran deal. He violated the Iran deal. This is a violation of an international treaty. That's not the kind of thing you do in a press conference. And he's such a dumb shit, he doesn't get it. And he doesn't understand why it's bad.
That's the flip side of it, of course, because he could have done it in a smarter way.
Right.
But he doesn't do anything in a smart way. Really, I mean, he's the bull in the china shop.
Yep.
You know?
Or the horse in the hospital, if the tip of the hat to John Mulaney.
And, you know, on the other side of the what do you call it? The political coin, that Nazi one in Illinois.
Yeah. Now, Being in Illinois and knowing a little bit of the lay of the land about that, yeah, he won the primary. And I mean, this is a guy who really is. We're not just using the word Nazi as a pejorative. This is a guy who subscribes to that. You remember in the Blues Brothers, the whole I hate Illinois Nazis thing? He's one of them. But the thing is, he's running for state house or state senate in a district that is so heavily Democratic that the only Republicans there are other Nazis. So he was bound to win that primary, but he's going to get his brains beaten in. I mean, if he gets 1% of the vote in the general election, I will be shocked.
And there was some Republican that ran in Virginia who got his ass whooped. Not surprisingly, because he's a convicted felon.
Oh, West Virginia. Yeah, yeah. You're talking about Don Blankenship.
Blankenship, yes.
I interviewed Don Blankenship once many years ago, and it was before he went to prison by about a year. And it was one of the worst interviews I've ever done in my life because he's such an idiot. And he did nothing but lie through his teeth the entire time, which, again, doesn't come as much of a shock. And the entire interview was him making his case that the mine explosion wasn't his fault, which it was, and I never aired it. And I've still got it somewhere, but it's never seen the light of day because I won't do that to my audience.
And speaking of convicted felons running for office, meanwhile here in Staten Island, Michael Grimm, the convicted former congressman.
Yes, I'll throw you off this balcony.
That's right. He's running against current Congressman Dan Donovan. And the last glimpse, and you have to remember, polls A should never be believed in B. It's a Staten Island poll, so how scientific, and I'm using that in air quotes, you could take that to the bank, really. He was leading.
Wow.
But now keep in mind a couple of things. One, Michael Grimm is truly the lowest of the low. He is a vile excuse of a human being. There is nothing about that man that is redeeming. While Dan Donovan is a bit of a wishy-washy, kind of spineless, typical politician, it wouldn't matter if he was Democrat or Republican, if he happens to be a Republican, and he was the former DA, I think at the end of the day, Staten Island will not vote for Michael Grimm. There's a dark horse in this race. His name is Max Rose. He's a young Democrat, but he's of that Bernie Sanders ilk.
Oh, okay.
Let's forget about him and concentrate on Grimm versus Donovan and hope that Donovan can really just kind of put his resources in the right direction and bury Grimm once and for all, because we don't need – listen, the guy cost us – and I think we talked about this – on Overnight America, when Grimm was running for re-election, after he had been indicted, this wasn't a case of investigated and arrested. He was indicted and going to prison, and he still ran, and they still voted for him, and he cost us millions of tax dollars because we had to hold a special election. Staten Islanders should be remembering this very clearly. And what I hate so much about my fellow Islanders is that they all have selective amnesia at the worst moments.
Yeah. And, you know, meanwhile, back on the national scene, we've got Donald Trump, who moved the Israeli embassy from Tel Aviv, where it had been forever, into Jerusalem, and all of the attendant shit that has gone on since then. But you know, the one thing that I thought was interesting about that, well, two, actually. One is that he dragged Mike Huckabee along with him for some unknown reason. And I don't know who was busy throwing the raw bison meat and dead ferrets to Sarah Huckabee Sanders in his absence, but Huckabee was over in Israel. And the other interesting thing about it is that he brought a Christian pastor to do some kind of invocation while they were busy, you know, dedicating this thing. And it happens to be a guy who has gone on record in the past, because he's a Southern Baptist, I think. If not, he's real close to that. He's gone on record in the past as saying that all Jews are going to hell, and that Mormonism is a cult and a... what did he say? It was something. It was like a plot directly from Satan or something like that. Went after anybody who isn't not only a Christian but his brand of Christianity, because he's torpedoed the Catholics too. Is somebody that was sent by Satan to kill God's work, and this is the guy Donald Trump brings with him to dedicate the new embassy in Jerusalem. Great move.
Well, one, Jews don't go to hell because they don't believe in hell.
Right.
I know this for a fact because I'm a Jew.
Because, right, so exactly.
That's number one. So we don't believe in it. What we do is we go to Florida, which is basically hell anyway. No offense.
I can confirm.
But you're a New Yorker, so it doesn't really count, which is the chain, you know. Jew from New York goes to Florida. Exactly. Surprise, surprise, surprise.
That's the law.
Right. That's where it's written in the scriptures. As far as Mormonism being a cult, it is. You know, that's that. So is Christian Science. So is Scientology.
Scientology is not even a cult.
Well, that's true, too. But, you know, for brevity's sake, if you're into that whole brevity thing. And, you know, if you're a papist, well, you know, my dad was a papist, so.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, on the Scientology front, you forgot to mention while we were talking about the cancellations that Kevin Can Wait, the new vehicle for Kevin James, has also been canceled by CBS. So, you know, Leah Remini was back on that show. So score one for Xenu. Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, just crazy. You know,
Well, Kevin James is a tool. And second of all, he can only play one character.
Right.
That's it. And he's got about as much range, comedy and acting wise, as a Daisy air rifle. So, you know, forget him. Yeah. Leah Remini. Oh, I love Leah Remini.
Oh, she's great. For the 15 people who have not yet watched the series that she did on Scientology, both seasons of it, go watch that now.
I watched one. It was really, really fantastic. Yeah. I mean, and I'm happy for her that she was smart enough, like many people have done since, to get herself away.
Right. You know? Yeah, Paul Haggis left. Who's the guy that's on Chicago Fire or Chicago PD? Jason Begay. Oh,
right.
He left. I mean, there's been a bunch of people. The ones that are really talented and smart eventually find a way out of it because they get to that point where it's like, I don't give a shit. If you're going to go out and tell everybody that I used to masturbate a lot when I was 13, go ahead.
Yeah, really. I mean, that whole – well, Going Clear was a really powerful piece to watch.
Right.
And so, you know, if you can find it, folks, watch it. You know, it's an HBO film, but it might probably be on Netflix or Amazon services, something like that.
He's another fascinating guy that I've had on the show before, the one who did Going Clear. He wrote the book. Boy, I wish I could pull his name out of my memory banks right now. But he's a reporter, and he worked for a while for I think the New York Times, and you know, he did a series of exposés on Scientology, and they came after his ass. I mean, they really.
It's on film too.
Right, where he's got people that are standing in his driveway yelling at him and all of this stuff. It's
knocking on his door.
Right.
Hassling his wife.
Yep.
You know.
So yeah, it's definitely worth not only watching the documentary but reading his stuff as well. So
they're just invasive, nasty people.
Oh yeah.
You want to talk about evil? That's evil. You know,
no doubt.
On a low level, but it's still evil, no matter how you slice it, because they're stalkers.
Right. And you know, jumping from that into the Me Too movement, because that's one of the things that Scientology has had one of the worst records on. I mean, they've been awful to everybody, so it's not much of a shock that their record on dealing with women has been pathetic. And so many women have reported sexual assaults and all of this stuff by high-level members of the Church of Scientology. So into the middle of all of this, we finally have, and you kind of knew this was coming by the script as well, that there was going to be somebody who was going to try to cover his own ass in the Me Too movement, somebody who had committed the sins of the, you know, that the Me Too movement was exposing, who was going to try and cover himself by pretending to be a champion. And now we know who it is, and he was the Attorney General of the state of New York.
Oh, Mr. Bluster, Mr. Swagger, Mr. Puff Chest Bravado. You mean Elliot Spitzer number two?
Yeah, Eric Schneiderman? The amazing Schneiderman.
Hey, note to all Jews.
Uh-huh.
Stop. You make us look bad. People like me and you, we can do that kind of shit because it's our job. We are members of the Fourth Estate. We are entertainers. We are, you know, somewhat comics. You know, we're hosts. We're here as an entertainment. We say things inappropriately because we don't get paid to, so we can say whatever we want, and we're under no jurisdiction. You're the Attorney General of New York, and you're a Jew. we're already having enough problems with the Jew factor, you know? Stop it. Just stop.
Yes.
Now, on the other hand, he's an asshole. And he deserves what he gets.
Yeah.
Just like Spitzer, just like Carlos Danger, Anthony Weiner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, anyone who does that kind of two-faced nonsense, whatever befalls you, you should get it tenfold.
Right.
You really deserve every moment of investigation and indictment and your name being dragged through the mud for your pompous, pious hypocrisy.
Definitely. And yeah, so nobody's going to shed any tears for Eric Schneiderman or for any of the other ones, nor should they. And I'll tell you, I am so glad that idea that Charlie Rose had about trying to start a TV show, you know, as basically being an apologist for all of these guys and saying, look at how their lives have been ruined by the Me Too movement. And of all people, Charlie Rose, somebody who lost his job over all of this, was going to try to put this together. And every producer and every director and everybody who could possibly do it has said, no fucking way. I'm out.
Well, what can I say about all of this stuff? I mean, it's like everything else we have been bombarded with over the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been, it's driven into you like a car. You're pinned up against a tree.
Right.
And it keeps backing up and hitting you over and over and over again. You know? Whoever's going to get caught out is going to get caught out. You know, how much truth will out in the end? Who knows? You know, it's one of those untenable things.
The one thing that we haven't seen yet, and this is, again, a part of the script, so I'm going to go on record right now as saying this is the one you have to watch out for, is that there will be somebody who will undergo a very public fall, who will protest his innocence, and will be proven out to have been innocent. Somebody will beat the rap. Somebody will be the poster child for this. Say
someone will be vindicated.
Right.
Unfortunately. Well, no. Fortunately, if they are innocent, because that's the whole point of law.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, but when that happens, and it's going to be somebody who will lose a job and a career and all of this, and eventually it will come out that it was all based on a lie. It will be the McMartin preschool thing all over again. And when that happens, it will give the Sean Hannitys and the Rush Limbaughs and all of the other assholes the ability to say, see, we told you it was a bunch of lying women, because they'll take one case and just condemn the entire movement for it.
The problem is with that, it should not even be an obvious, I'm speaking in the most obvious terms, it shouldn't even be a political party thing. It should be a human thing, because that's what this is about. And people lose sight of that with such ease. Every one of these horror stories, if you will, becomes instead a cause celeb for a political movement or a particular strain of something.
Right.
Instead of being taken on the merits of what it is.
Right. And in you brought up Spitzer was a Democrat. Schneiderman was a Democrat. Anthony Weiner was a Democrat. You know, so it's not a political thing from that respect. But when it comes to the people like Hannity and Limbaugh and O'Reilly before him and all of the other ones who have been constantly denigrating any attempt by women to say that this kind of stuff still goes on, those guys are all on the right. Every single one of them.
Completely correct.
So
it's amazing that while Ailes and O'Reilly have, quote, been cashiered out of the way for the moment, Hannity, Limbaugh, you know, those guys are just as culpable and probably guiltier than anybody else.
Right. It was Limbaugh who came back from the Dominican Republic with a bag full of Viagra that wasn't his. Well, gee, what do you suppose he was doing down there?
Going deaf from all the drugs he was taking? Yeah,
that had already happened.
Ditto.
Yeah, ditto, because you're going to have to say that again. I'm a little deep in this here. So that said, we do have some music to talk about. And once again, it brings us to one of our favorites, because you and I have both been so taken by the voice of Lisa Saeed. And you've now gotten the chance, and we talked about this a little while ago, that a song had been released from her upcoming new EP from the Pyramid Scheme. Go back through some of the DNA on this and Lisa Saeed and how she put this band together.
They're the guys that have played with her on her previous two records, and it just seemed natural because she looks at them as, you know, well, they're not my sidemen, they're my bandmates, right. You know, and their talents are equal. And that's how any band should quote unquote develop, really, if you're going to go into that angle rather than being a solo artist. You know, I'm sure she can do both with ease because she's that talented. Obviously, I'm quite taken with her, and she, I think she's fantastic. And, you know, I always look forward to what she's going to present next. And the thing is that she works really well in a band scenario, you know. And so Pyramid Scheme was born very wittily with an EP called Get Rich Quick 2, you know. notice it's done deliberately without Get Rich Quick, comma, two. There's no comma right there. So that's – I like the way she did it. It's the way she approaches things is very methodical but with a wink and a nod, and I get it, you know. But the thing is, you know, she has that voice that you just – you can't help but be smitten by first and foremost.
Right.
And this is no different. It's just that it's more of an upfront three-piece band all in all with some guitar overdubs. It's a really great, solid five song. I'm a little tired, so I'm a little slower than usual. And as per usual, she delivers nothing but melody. But the great thing is you hear the band members showcase it. That rhythm section is terrific. They're deep and they're rich, and you can tell they're locked in.
Right, and there's also a tremendous amount of warmth in it. The way the production is done on this is a very comfortable feel to it. And as much as, you know, the musicianship has got to be first and foremost, I've heard good musicianship badly produced, and it really does detract from it. Here, that doesn't happen because whoever was in charge of that really had a feel for a way to make something sound classic without making it sound old.
Well, that, once again, are the vigilant ears of Don Zientara.
Ah, okay.
In her ear studio. So there, it's really no surprise. And because she's worked with him now for how many years? 2-3 years at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Know each other so well that he knows how to work with her and with the band, you know? I mean, there's mixtures of that kind of REM mid-period texture.
Yes.
There's a song called No More Anymore, which is, to me, the weird standout track, in a good way I say weird, because this is – it's what I like to call super rock. You know, it's that power pop with a punch,
mm-hmm.
where it just blasts out at you. And you don't really expect that, and I don't want to say predictably, from Lisa Saeed. You expect something a bit more downplayed, you know, because she does have that Velvet Underground influence, you know, coming out of the Wazoo.
Right.
Which is where, you get it on Regular Guy. That's, you know, a Lisa Saeed style track, you know, but it's just, it's this particular song, No More Anymore. It's kind of like when you heard the Posies for the first time or Teenage Fan Club, big star. So, you know, it's that kind of, I can say these things because I write a lot about big star.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, but it's the beauty of doing something different in the midst of something that you think is going to be a certain way. You get, you know, you completely surprise the listener.
Right.
And I think it's terrific. And on the last track, Pay to Play, again on the monetary theme, it almost sounds like, and maybe it's because she's using a Jaguar, I'm not sure, but she definitely veers into that whole lush My Bloody Valentine kind of sound. You know, that I don't want to use the word shoegazer, but that whole drone and feedback, but it never becomes abrasive and distracting.
Yeah, right. And again, that's a great musician and a very deft producer at work. So definitely got to check out the review for this one, the new Pyramid Scheme offering. And the other new music we have to talk about, and I love this because label geeks as we both are, this one draws its DNA back to one of the most important labels of the late 1970s, Stiff Records, who gave us a young man out of England by the name of Eric Goulden. Reckless Eric is back.
You know, when I first heard Reckless Eric in, I guess it was the beginning of 1980. It was on WNEW, because there's a story here, you know, and that's how much longevity there is in his career, first of all.
Yeah.
It was in 1980, and Stiff Epic, remember them?
Yes.
Stiff Epic was touting his new release, which was his first American release, the double LP Big Smash, which I bought and played White Grooves right into. Yeah. That album has been beaten to death by me. And I, you know, when the Punchline, 7 years later, were together, we actually covered one of the songs from that album, the gorgeous, and I do mean gorgeous, and classic, Broken Doll, which Cliff Richard actually covered and had a minor hit with. But this was an album that gave us songs like Pop Song, which was the first song, and it was actually the first video I ever saw by him, because it was on Rock World on Friday night.
Off our books, we want a pop song.
Because it was the same episode that had Lena Lovitch and Jonah Louie and Dirty Looks. But Reckless Eric made an immediate impact on me with Pop Song, Take the Cash, Take the K-A-S-H.
Yes.
I'd Go the Whole Wide World, which the Monkees covered. Yep. A lot of bands covered that song. I always found that to be wrong that they covered it with Mickey singing lead. Davey obviously should have sang the lead on it because he would have done it perfectly. But Reckless Eric put out all these wonderful singles and kind of walked away from being disgusted and disheartened by the years on Stiff Records. He then formed a band called the Len Bright Combo, you know, moved to France, did an album under the name of I think it was under Eric Goulden rather than Reckless Eric, the Donovan of Trash. He later married Amy Rigby.
Uh-huh.
Where they split time between England, France, and the United States. And now he's put out his first new album under the name of Reckless Eric, and God only knows how long. And it's called Construction Time and Demolition. And it's a semi-concept album, which you never hear about in this day and age. And he hasn't lost it one bit. It's good. A little lower voltage. It's not as, I really don't like to use the word, but the thing about Reckless Eric is that it was kind of jolly, pithy drinking music, you know, in the earlier days. Now it's a lot more thoughtful, a little bit more sarcastic than sardonic. And let's just put it this way. It's an older, much more world-weary Reckless Eric. And it's a terrific album. You know, it's very 60s also.
Good. And that's interesting for him to go back 10 years before he really got his start.
Well, the thing is, he went back to the music that he cut his teeth on.
Yeah.
I think that's the basic gist of it. I mean, you know, Gateway to Europe sounds like something that Ray Davies would have written. It definitely fits in that whole Village Green Preservation Society kind of mindset. And it's one of those lyrical paintings, you know?
Yeah.
It also has a very 60s arrangement with a lot of punchy horns. He also gets jazzy with a song called The World Revolved Around Me. You can take it as an almost autobiographical look back, but, you know, lyrics are always open to interpretation, and I don't like to go into that into too much depth, because what I hear may not be what your perception is. So sure. I don't want to do it an injustice. They Don't Mean No Harm basically is Reckless Eric of old. A little bit slower, but it's that voice, that kind of snarl that he used to use when he was trying to get a point across in his songs.
That's cool.
So this is definitely one of those albums that you kind of welcome back the warrior who's been gone low these many decades and comes in out of the cold, you know, battle-scarred, but nonetheless still has his talents and his skills completely intact.
Excellent. Well, you know, and going back to the stiff epic years from, I guess it was like 76 or 77 all the way through the early part of the 1980s, you said something in there about how it was that sort of good time drinking music. And, you know, you look at some of the other artists that were a part of that madness. Elvis Costello, one of my all-time favorites, and it, as much as you talk about Big Star, I bang the drum for Ian Dury and the Blockheads. Also, had a connection to Stiff Epic. You know, it was a lot of that stuff, and that sadly is something that we don't hear anywhere near enough of anymore. You know, nobody seems to be able to write those kinds of songs. Oh, and Nick Lowe. Let us not forget his time in that label as well.
Lena Lovitch.
Yep.
Dr. Feelgood, who funded the label to get off the ground. Later joined the stiff roster of artists, My Beloved Dirty Looks.
Yeah.
All hail. Hosanna. Who else? I'm trying to think of all this stuff. Ten Pole Tudor.
Right. Devo also made Devo an appearance on stiff.
Yes, indeed. In England, they were. Rachel Sweet.
There's a name I haven't heard in a while.
Any Trouble.
Yep.
Any Trouble, which gave the world Clive Gregson. I mean, there were just so many wonderful artists that Stiff Records bore unto us, you know? Of course, the Pogues.
Yeah. So, back when you could see a label on a 45 and get really excited about it, even before you knew whose name was on it. Very cool.
The thing is, Stiff was one of those record labels, not just for the geeks like us, but they were one of those record labels where it was about the label. You know, all the artists, if you knew something new was coming out on Stiff, you went and got it. You know, Stiff was an entity unto themselves, you know?
Was Wendy O. Williams associated with Stiff as well?
Yes, indeed, the Plasmatics.
The Plasmatics days, okay, right.
Stiff, yes. Before they moved over to Capitol, of all things.
Right, right. Yeah, well, and that's, I mean, the Geez Madness moved to Geffen. So, you know, there's a lot of that stuff.
Accidentally, somehow.
Yeah.
The Stranglers, the Gospel According to the Men in Black wound up on Stiff America, which was after the Epic deal had expired. They moved over and became completely independent to number 5 Crosby Street, which was later taken over by Mute Records. And there were some very odd releases that came out on Stiff America, and that somehow that's one Stranglers album became the anomaly in the United States, because everything else up to that point came out on United Artists. No, sorry, A&M in the United States.
Yeah.
They were on A&M. So anyway, Stiff Records, always, whenever I think about them, I always feel very warm, and it brings back nothing but wonderful, happy memories. But, you know, those are the formative teen years for me. Stiff, IRS, you knew what you were getting the minute you bought anything that came out on those labels. It was going to be weird. It was going to be different. And it was going to be something that would live with you forever.
Exactly. It was going to be quality, no doubt. Well, before we get to In Our Heads, I'm going to hand it back over to you. And anything else you got going on before we do that thing and wrap the show?
Yeah, I'm here to actually sort of preach for a moment, because, you know, about 22, 23 years ago, I'd gone back into my childhood, and I don't remember what exactly had spurned it on, but I became immensely obsessed with reacquiring the entire album output by the Love and Spoonful. And this is a band that people gave me no end of static for really getting back into.
Uh-huh.
And if you can talk about a band that was about as perfect as you could get from New York, this was it. This was the ultimate New York band as far as I was concerned. And it's just been in the last week or two that it's happening all over again.
What?
You know, I'm listening to those. Well, I have the remastered CDs. And even though their output overall was not great, I mean, it was only 5 albums, the Love and Spoonful just, you know, you talk about when you listen to certain records that give you such an uplift.
Yeah.
That when I put on, well, Rain on the Roof makes me veer between absolute joy to just wanting to cry because of the sheer beauty of it. It is one of the most perfect compositions ever committed to tape. When you listen to it, especially if you have that remastered disc, because it has the instrumental track by itself,
right,
which is a stunning exercise when you hear it. But you go back and you listen to the beauty of those songs. You know, Rain on the Roof, You Didn't Have to Be So Nice, Daydream. Yeah, I do like Do You Believe in Magic. It's kind of a nice little breezy song. 6 o'clock, She's Still a Mystery, Darling Be Home Soon. You know, yep, Summer in the City is probably the greatest summertime song of all time. But then there's those album tracks that people either forget about or don't know at all. Songs like There She Is or It's Not Time Now, Fish and Blues, certainly Nashville Cats. You know, it's just, it's a band that I don't think gets their due, is appreciated as much as they should be. And going back to when we did a remote Overnight America, when I was in Atlanta, and I did the book review for Steve Boone's autobiography, My Life on the Run with the Love and Spoonful.
Yeah.
You know, that, I would have thought it would have started then, but I just started rereading it now in the wake of listening to the records again. And I got to tell you, it's an incredible read. So
cool.
This is
That's
the week of the Love and Spoonful. People, you need to check them out.
Yeah.
On Cabin Future Records, distributed by MGM. How's that?
There you go. Well, and Sebastian was always one of those guys that also, he was never satisfied with making pop songs that were just major chord, minor chord, seventh. There was a lot more to them. You know what I mean? And he played around with some jazz influence and some other things that went into what you described as just very breezy pop songs.
And the beauty of it is that they were all so into musics and very much
right.
American musics. You know, Zalianowski, who's just one of the most criminally overlooked and underrated, amazing guitarists, pure guitarists. He was a Jew. He had this innate sense of knowing what to play, how to play it, and when to play it. And they used the blues and jazz and Appalachian music. And yeah, there's some definite soul influences.
Right.
And yep, there's good old rock and roll in there. And there's some Baroque when you're not looking. I mean, for God's sakes, Rain on the Roof employs an Irish harp. You know, it's just... what an amazing band. I'm so glad I just decided to start listening to them again, because it certainly took me out of the rut that I started to, I think, go into.
Yeah, well, just remember, if it ain't Baroque, don't fix it. So I had to. It was laying right there.
You're all weak. Try the veal.
And tip your weight, Steph.
Speaking of meats, let's talk about this Florida baby toss.
Oh, yeah, I posted a little picture that a buddy of mine found online, because there was a family in Florida. They were messing around on the beach, and they decided, I guess it was a photo shoot for one thing or another. And then, you know, the kids, there was a kid who's probably about 3 and another kid who's a baby, and they started to get restless like kids do. So the photog very brilliantly said, why don't we just take some time? We'll just walk down the beach. We won't do anything that's, you know, we'll try to get a couple of candid shots, but we're not going to set anything up. So just go and play. So they started to do this, and they were swinging the 3-year-old in between the mom and the dad. And then all of a sudden, the 1-year-old, who had about had it by this time, decided to do what 1-year-olds do, kicked his legs and backflipped right out of his mom's arms. And there's this brilliant shot of her looking horrified as this baby tumbles from her arms down onto the sand below.
And all I could think of, well, you know, when you're done tossing these little brats around, what's the sensible thing? Have a baby queue on the beach. And those kids are the right age to cook, because, first of all, we know how quickly... Look, we know how quickly a baby can, you know, be roasted.
Right.
And a 3-year-old is perfect because it'll feed the whole family. They plump when you cook them, you know. And, you know, while a baby will taste like chicken, you know, the kid, the bigger kid's going to taste like pork.
And they haven't toughened up yet. They're still too young. So,
and,
Oh, man. Never go to Florida. Just trust me on this one. Stay out of that place. It's no good for you. So,
unless you have body parts in the trunk.
Yeah, right. In which case, they'll welcome you with open arms and give you a free glass of orange juice at the border. Which brings us quite nicely to In Our Heads. And I want to take this one off and give all credit to a good friend of mine, Peter King, who is a longtime CBS newsman and occasionally anchors the CBS radio news. So be on the lookout for him. He's a tremendously nice guy. And for a long time did the NASA beat reporting because he lives in Central Florida and would drive over to Cocoa from time to time and see a launch and do the reporting on all of that. But Peter posted something this week about reading a biography I did not know existed. It's a biography of Alan Sherman. And I love Alan Sherman. Alan Sherman, when I was 3 or 4, my Uncle Glenn sent an 8-track to my dad that Glenn had recorded himself. He was one of the fancy ones who had an 8-track recorder. And he did a mixtape for my dad. And there was a bunch of Alan Sherman on there. And it was not Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, because that's not Glenn's style. But he put a song on there called I See Bones, which is done to C'est Bon. And it's about, you know, a doctor looking at an x-ray. And it's 3 minutes of absolute hilarity.
I see your spine. And your spine looks divine. It's exactly like mine. Now doesn't that seem strange? Phones. There's $2 in change among your lovely bones.
Now that I'm really excited about this, and thank you, Peter, for letting me know that this biography of Alan Sherman is out there bouncing around. But I thought, you know, I'm going to go into the catalog of Alan Sherman a little bit. And because he was also, you know, a Jew, you know, was that the kind of thing that appealed to you as well? That kind of goofy Tom Lehrer, Alan Sherman type humor, and even guys like Mark Russell, who could take a piano and make a parody song that would just knock you flat because it was so funny and so intelligently written.
First of all, it is incredibly hilarious and equally eerie that you're bringing up Alan Sherman, because a friend of mine had posted, you know how we were doing that name the 10 most influential albums?
Yeah.
Well, he posted an album that I grew up with that was considered religion in my household, My Son the Folk Singer.
My Son the Folk Singer.
And
great
so
record.
The thread went on for days because all we started doing, like, you know how we always do with the Ruddles? All of a sudden, all these very very, you know, anglicized names were coming out of the woodwork, but it turns out they're all Jews.
Right.
And all of us were taking quotes from the album. So what can I say beyond Seltzer Boy, where are you hiding? If you don't come right now, I'm going to tell you, boss, on you.
Don't bring me water. I gotta have seltzer. Cause water don't bubble. And water don't fizz. Water, I hate it. Cause it ain't carbonated. But a glass of seltzer, on the other hand, is.
Boy.
Yeah. And you know, he
that
was.
That album was religion in my house. You don't understand. That was like the holiest of holy records. Whether it was Seltzer Boy, whether it was. The one that always made me, besides Seltzer Boy being my favorite, Jump Down, Spin Around, Pick a Dress of Cotton.
Yep.
What's the other one?
How about?
Oh, there was this weird that he did with where he's talking about, talking about I went down to Mount Sinai Hospital to see my old Sadie there. She said, thank God for the Blue Cross, and I wish they had the Medicare. I mean, it's just this. If you grew up in a Jewish household, and I said the word out loud,
yep.
I know, in that era, it is probably best odds that your family has some kind of connection to New York, especially if you're in New York, and connections somehow to the Borscht Belt in the Catskill Mountains, where all of this really is born of.
Right.
And my son, the folk singer, was just part of the fabric of the family. My family was always great about ruining every holiday and birthday, but when they got together, I mean, there's no way around it. My aunt could come over and just fuck it up in the blink of an eye. Put on my son, the folk singer, and everybody shuts the hell up.
Right.
And just starts laughing.
And starts laughing right next to the same person they were just yelling at. And yeah, it's.
Right. And everybody's singing along. And they don't stop singing until the album's over. Now, I don't particularly care for Hello Mother, Hello Father,
no.
Because I've heard it too many times. But the flip side, I think that was his greatest moment, his tour de force, Ratfink, which is it was a song called Ragmop originally, but his delivery is, you know, R-A-R-A-T-R-A-T-T, rat, R-A-T-T-F-I-N-K, Ratfink, and these very obviously Hadassah-sounding chick singers in the background going, yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, it's just corny and it's hilarious, but it's part of who I am because I grew up on this stuff.
Right.
And by the way, people also forget Alan Sherman's the original Cat in the Hat.
Right.
Cat, hat, in French, chapeau. In Spanish, it's El Gato is a sombrero.
Yeah, and you know, in addition to that, there are a couple of other tunes that I remember vividly from my childhood, and it was the same way. I mean, Alan Sherman, when he was on, everybody was just listening and laughing, is the Hungarian Goulash number 5. That one just slays. And it's funny because, you know, later on, listening to Weird Al, and I don't know, I mean, I'm sure that Weird Al grew up on these same records because most of the songs that he's written that, you know, that are truly funny, it's about the mundane parts of life. And if you can take those and show everybody how funny they are, that's when it becomes brilliant comedy. So how many songs has Weird Al written about food? I mean, forget Eat It. He's done 100 of them and it's the same thing. Which one? Yes.
My Bologna.
Yes, right.
My Bologna.
Under the pseudonym The Snack. But yes, that was indeed Weird Al. And, you know, listening to Hungarian Goulash, you can hear the same thing. It's just him, you know, reciting all of these dishes that his family used to cook when he was a kid. And it's hilarious because it's done over top of a piece of music that we all knew.
Then there's Blobber, the favorite of the frigid Eskimo. Such delicious dishes, no matter where you go. Chicken cacciatore is Italian. Kangaroo souffle must be Australian. Mutton chops are definitely British. Chicken soup undoubtedly is Yiddish.
Same thing with, well, shit, how about Pop Hates the Beatles?
Yep.
You know, yep. And how many, when that song came out, how many teenagers in the United States, Jewish or not, were going through that same thing? I can't listen to my records. My dad hates them.
Right. But the thing is, you know, it's that I don't want to say it's a cultural thing. I think it's just a case because really comedy is universal.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of obvious. Yiddish humor, Catskills Yiddish humor, is a certain brand. I mean, look, Rickles was Catskills.
Yep.
You know, Alan King was Catskills. You know, some of the things you and I love from Warner Brothers, you know, Daffy Duck doing book review when he does Cucaracha, yeah. Right? That's Danny Kaye.
Right.
You know, this is all Catskills Yiddish humor, you know? And Alan Sherman is no different. I mean, and you, especially having lived in Florida, you know, when he starts to sing, as I wandered out on the streets of Miami. I mean, come on.
Yes. So, yeah, it's
I have been remiss, and I have to start sending some of my kids some of this stuff, because like you said, I mean, I grew up on it, you grew up on it, it was always around, and sadly, I think it's also being sort of left by the wayside, but I can't wait to get a hold of this book now, because I have to find out what that life was like that led to that head.
It's a good question, because a few things that I have read about him, they were not flattering, actually. Really? I mean, the fact that he had absolutely next to no relationship with his kids.
Yeah.
He was something of a loner and a surly guy, but isn't that always the way with great comic genius?
Right. Yeah, it's a very solitary world.
Yeah, I mean, not to put a negative spin on it, but hey, you know, the minute I saw that horrible, you know, cover with him standing there and the woman with the seltzer bottle on a column and she's holding a chicken, you know, I mean, I was catapulted back to being 5 years old and sitting there with my cousins, and we're listening to this Fakakta album and just, you know, laughing our asses off.
That's it. Well, yeah, same rules apply. Leave us more stuff in the comments section, and we will wrap it up for this time around. And Rob Ross, brilliant as always, my man, and I will look forward to talking to you, and I know we'll have much more to go on when it comes to Sunday next.
And I think now I'm going to go dig up my copy of My Son the Folk Singer and go listen to it while having a bowl of matzo ball soup.
Enjoy
with some
knedlach.
His faith is in. I will see you next week.